Yeah, no, no chance.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network in memory of my sister, Marsha Joyce, who started this whole thing and made me do it, and I'm glad she did. And the sun is not shining, but that's okay. We don't care because we've got Caitlin Strong here, and she's strong enough to make the sun come out, believe me, when she gets to, when she gets to know her. This novel is really cool because teenagers really need to read it. When you go to a bar, and I learned that the hard way when I first started to teach at 17 and a half, you go to a bar with your friends, never leave your drink on the table and come back and drink it. You're going to find out why when we talk about strong to the bone. And I learned that when somebody spiked my drink with vodka and I don't drink. And that was not a happy sight at the end. So what happens in this novel, caught Wesley Masters. I love that character. He's really cool. And we're going to talk to John Land. Good morning, John. How goes it?
It goes great, Fran. It's always the highlight of when a book releases. I get to come on and talk to you.
Yeah, it makes my day, let me tell you. So Caitlin Strong is often highly impulsive, volatile when linking this case to the past. How does it affect her in the present? And why is she so bent on finding the person that defiled her in the past?
Well, I think there is this incident when she was sexually assaulted 18 years ago. We find that out very early and strong to the bone. Mm-hmm. When another young woman about the same age as Caitlin was when she was sexually assaulted is attacked by what turns out to be the same man. So why it's important is this is something that has haunted her for 18 years, and this is actually the case with women who suffer from this. And by the way, men also suffer from sexual mm-hmm. assault. That's a little known fact. We can get into that later. But she has it's been like a sore that hasn't healed, an itch she can't reach for 18 years. And now she has the opportunity as a Texas Ranger, and this is what motivated her to become a Texas Ranger like her father and grandfather and everyone else before in the family. It was this incident, and now she has an opportunity to do what she couldn't do 18 years ago. She's not helpless and weak anymore. She's a Texas Ranger. But, and this is where Caitlin surprised me, and this is why I enjoy writing this series so much and why I think Strong to the Bone, I'm not sure it's my favorite in the series, but I think it's the best. And the reason is, organically, something I wasn't expecting. Caitlin is afraid to catch her attacker. She's afraid to catch him because she's worried that's where her edge comes from. That's where her rage comes from. That's the defining moment that made her who she is. And she's afraid if she catches him, she'll sacrifice that part of her personality. That she'll sacrifice that edge. So there's an ambiguity. There's a duality of her nature, of her character, which is a very rare thing in thriller fiction today. It's something you normally see in traditional fiction. But here's the thing, Fran, and this is what we may want to touch on. I wrote this book a year ago, and there had been no Harvey Weinstein allegations and. There had been no, God help us all, Roy Moore, oh my God. There had been no, you know, the Donald Trump stuff was all in the news. But this explosion of people who are, being victimized and suffering through exactly what I portray in the book. But that's the nature of the thriller genre. The nature of the thriller genre is to hold a mirror up to society in many ways that traditional fiction doesn't. So I think I, to a degree, I hate to phrase it like this, to a degree, current events were very fortuitous for me in terms of this book. It couldn't have been better timed as far as making this book, the subject matter of Strong to the Bone, making it relevant.
I agree with you. And I just heard it on the news this morning right before I logged in that our president is endorsing Moore for Senator of Alabama. And that is really mind-boggling.
There is a portion of this nation that has normalized the behavior of Moore and Trump. It is a small percentage. It is very scary. It's very scary, but it goes to the nature of villainy. It goes to the nature of evil. Because the other thing we see in Strong to the Bone is the villains are neo-Nazis. Literally, as you'll see when you get to the twist, the big twist in the book. But literally. And these people are filled with nothing but hatred. That's all they want. And they make up. They make up this, what is it, 20, 25%, basically the Trump supporters of this country. Mm-hmm. And they are, look, you know, Hillary Clinton used the term deplorable. I'm gonna make a statement. I might lose some readers down south. Anyone who votes for Roy Moore is reprehensible. Anyone who votes for him is deplorable. Because if you vote for Roy Moore in Alabama, if you support Roy Moore in Rhode Island or New York, you are enabling the behavior of people like him and the person in fiction who raped Caitlin Strong. And if you do that, you are an accessory. You are just as guilty. And if you have a child of your own, if you have your own family, and you can still vote for that man or vote for Donald Trump or support Donald Trump and look yourself in the mirror, I don't know what you're going to see looking back.
Is that you better than me?
No,
I agree with you. I agree with you because, you know, going to college, I had an incident with a professor that said if I wasn't nice to him, he was going to fail me. And
nice
I
in
said,
quotes.
Really? Yeah, exactly. And
nice.
He said, because I can't sing, I was a music major. So I said to him, I really can't sing, and I'm doing my best. And he wanted me to sing an aria from Don Giovanni. I said, I could sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, but I can't sing that. So I did my best, and he said, well, if you let me drive you home a couple of times, maybe we could work something out. I worked it out with the head of the department. I went right to the head of the department and reported it. But I was lucky because my two friends were outside and heard him say it, too. I don't know if they kept him anymore. All I know is that there were a group of us that were sent to his class because the regular professor, the head of the department, was overcrowded, at which point I said, I would rather take a withdrawal, and I will not be in his presence ever again, and I went back to the other class, and they didn't argue with me. Obviously, he thought I was right. I don't know if they fired him or anything, but yeah.
You
got to speak up and speak out.
A problem has reached a saturation point. It's become relevant to the wider mainstream when it reaches pop culture. When you think about how pop culture has treated this issue, I think arguably the most powerful episode of The Sopranos ever was the episode where Dr. Melfi is sexually assaulted. That's Tony Soprano, the James Gandolfini character's psychiatrist. And a few episodes later, she finds her rapist accidentally. She happens to be bussing tables at a coffee shop. Mm-hmm. And the suspense lies in the next session with Tony. Does she tell him that this man who the police can't get, she's found him? She knows what Tony will do if she tells him, but she doesn't tell him. Because knowing she has the power is enough. And that's what it comes down to. And I think that's what comes out in Strong to the Bone. The horrible thing about sexual assault is it's one person imposing their will on another person. It's
that's
someone
right.
who has power exploiting someone who doesn't. And that in itself is just as bad as the act. So the idea that one of the two villains in Strong to the Bone has been doing this for so long, has been doing this with impunity, sound familiar what I'm about to say, without any consequences. This is what, so when Caitlin brings him down, literally as it turns out, when she will eventually get him in the end, if that's the case, don't want to have too many spoilers here, she becomes a symbol. She becomes representative, a cathartic moment where she is able to do, and I'm giving something away here, and I don't care because it's more important that we talk about this.
That's right.
She is able to do to her attacker what almost no sexual assault victims have ever been able to do to theirs. Now, that's changing. Title IX is changing it. The new culture is changing it. The fact that someone like Harvey Weinstein could be facing jail, the fact that someone as talented and successful as Kevin Spacey now revealed, you know, to have serious issues, to say the least, can have his career ended in a moment, shows that the catharsis is expanding. So I've never, you know, I've probably written books that are as good or better than Strong to the Bone. I've never written one as socially relevant as Strong to the Bone.
It certainly is. I mean, young people have to know when you go to a bar, I mean, this Frank put something in a paper cup. And Caitlin didn't realize that it was there because a lot of alcohol you can't taste. And I know from personal experience, vodka, you can't taste it. And you don't know, and put it in seltzer, and you just drink it. You don't know. So they have to learn, when you go to a bar, and you go to the bathroom, and you have a drink on the throw it away, and get another one. So tell us about Frank and why Caitlin and Colt Wesley decided to take action when they realized that something is happening to college students. Because it happens all over the world. I mean, my nephew is in school, and he tells me, he says, you know, you've got to be really careful when you're going out, because you never know what's going to happen.
I think you're getting to a very important point, and I'm around college students a lot because of my volunteer work at Brown University, and when you're dealing with a sober college student and they're nodding their head and they're listening to all the educational programs and stuff about don't do this, don't do that, and all that.
Mm-hmm.
When you're dealing with what you just said, that this is the point. When you're dealing with alcohol into the mix, all bets are off. Because now people aren't making the right choices, the inhibitions are down, and I think there are many times where men they miss the signals that women give them, they misinterpret those signals. But here's the thing about Strong to the Bone: the villain in Strong to the Bone cannot blame alcohol; he is a predator, and I think it's very important, both in fiction and fact, that we don't create false equivalencies. That there is a difference between a tragedy and a mass crime. A tragedy is something that happens when someone makes a mistake and makes a terribly bad choice and someone gets hurt. A crime is when someone like the villain in Strong to the Bone is preying on people. Alcohol has nothing to do with it. It's not spur of the moment. It's not a bad choice that he wishes he could take back. It's not Noah Cross in Chinatown saying, "Mr. Gitz, just as John Huston, I believe in the right situation, a man is capable of anything." It's not like that. This guy is a hunter. He's a villain. And if you want to quantify it, the fact that he's probably sexually assaulted 100 women is 100 times worse than the person who does it to one person. Now, there may be people who take issue with that, because hurting one person is a pretty serious thing. But I don't believe there's an equivalency any more than I believe there's an equivalency between what Roy Moore did, what Al Franken did, what John Connors did. They are all morally reprehensible. But like anything else, there are levels. You know, there are levels, and you can't put everything into the same basket, because some people deserve a much more heinous and villainous basket than other people. It's different sides of a very dark coin, but they must be respected as being different and not create this false equivalency. And that's what, in Strong to the Bone, you are facing an alpha predator. Caitlin is facing an alpha predator. But here's the fun, Frank, because you and I talk about villains a lot. No, you got writers who listen to your show. A lot of writers listen to your show. And here's something I just thought of. My traditional villain is usually someone who is physically imposing. It's usually someone who uses their physical capabilities and their aura, you know, to get what they want. You know, their physicality helps define their villainy. Well, this villain we're talking about, this serial sexual assaulter, this serial rapist, he's not a big guy. He doesn't shoot a gun. He doesn't use a knife. You know, he's a piece of crap in plain English. But he doesn't have the traditional qualities of the villains I've created in the past. Even in business, he's a failure. He's had to borrow hundreds of millions of dollars from this Nazi gang leader in order to stay in business. And that's where the fun of the book structurally comes in. You have these two morally reprehensible people who are basically in business together. And because of that, everything, the structural plot, we've been talking about the emotional core of Strong to the Bone. But again, as I like to talk about on your show, because of the number of writers you have and because of the readers who listen and want to know where books come from, I always have a structural core and an emotional core. And we've been talking about the emotional core. The thing I love about Strong to the Bone is how the emotional core and the structural core of the book, what Caitlin is feeling versus what Caitlin is doing, the link between them is so intrinsic and so tight. You can't separate one from the other. And in fact, as I just said, what leads to the world, what leads to a potential sea change in the way society functions, the way civilization, you know, goes forward, is directly because of these two men, because of this business deal that actually goes wrong, that something that happens, now they have power they weren't expecting. And the scary thing about giving evil people power is, again, as we've seen in current events all too often this past year, we've seen what happens when you give power to people who have no business having it. And that's the real structural fun I had in writing Strong to the Bone.
Yeah, this is like one of my favorite books, and this is just
it won your award.
Life.
It won your award.
I didn't know if you saw that. Yes, it did.
It won the
yesterday.
Award. Best Just Reviews MJ Magazine Best Historical Thriller. And I have to tell you something. That means a lot to me, and I'll tell you why. You know, it's not the first award I've won. I've been lucky in that respect, but it's the first time I've ever been recognized historically, and so much of this book, especially this book, but all my Caitlin Strong books, are about the past as much as they're about the present and how the past and the present connect. So the idea of being recognized for using history, something I've been doing in this series for 9 books now, and you're the first person to have recognized it in the way that you did. So that award means a lot to me because I'm being recognized for doing something no one ever recognized me for before. So I'm kind of excited. So I owe you. I have to say thank you on the show right now.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad because it's one of my favorite books, and I love Caitlin Strong, but this one really hit home, especially when you talk about the Nazis and the Holocaust, and my grandmother spent time in a concentration camp. I said, so, yeah. This was like, so when Caitlin, it's unknown people can go away. When she shoots the person she thinks raped Kelsey, this is the girl that gets raped. What happens when the DW, her boss, finds out? How does he handle it? And I love it because people have called me this. What did they call her, Hurricane? They call me Bulldozer.
they call her Hurricane because she's an unstoppable force. You know, once she is, you know, nothing will stop her from getting, when she sees a person she's trying to help, a criminal she's trying to get, nothing is going to get in her way, just like a hurricane. Nothing gets in the way of a hurricane. And I think when Tepper, her boss, I think he's concerned by her behavior. Because remember, she shoots a man she thinks is a rapist, but it turns out he's just a thief. And it wasn't a gun in his hand, it was a cell phone. And she shot him. And she's often in these books portrayed as a loose cannon. But she doesn't shoot innocent people. You know, and she's normally more disciplined. But I think how her boss responds to this is he's worried. Because it's one thing when you're chasing the dragon who's trying to burn man, who's trying to burn civilization. It's another thing when you're chasing the dragon who burned you. And it's a third thing when you're chasing the dragon who's trying to do both. And that's what mm-hmm. she understands, who's done both or is doing both. So, you know, it's – and it all goes back to, you know, so it all goes back to what happened. You know, this book started, Fran, and I know, you know, it's – I decided I wanted to do Nazis because the last three mm-hmm. books I did, China in Strong Darkness. The Russians were the bad guys in Strong Light of Day. And ISIS comes to Texas in Strong Cold Dead. So I'm thinking, what am I going to do next? And I'm thinking, well, I haven't done Nazis in a while. So the idea of doing Nazis, and so I Googled Nazis in Texas. Let's see what I find. And this is the great thing about being a writer. You never stop learning. I found there were, in World War II, 1943, 1944, there were 130,000 Nazi prisoner of wars, mostly from North Africa and the, you know, and the Africa Corps, Rommel's people, who were kept in prison camps in Texas. So I thought, oh my God. The light bulb went off, and I realized who one of these prisoners were. And we're getting into the history a little bit, but the historical subplot of Strong to the Bone, where you meet Caitlin's grandfather again, deals mm-hmm. with a triple murder that occurs in one of these prison camps. And who shows up to investigate? None other than J. Edgar Hoover himself. So clearly something big is going on. So the reason I raise that, is in the micro structurally, the macro emotionally. You have a very personal story of violence, revenge, and coping, what Caitlin has to deal with. And then in the macro, the big picture, the reader knows that there is something out there. The reader, he or she, has seen that in the past, someone got out of this prison camp for a reason. And that reason is still alive today. And that's why, and that's where the history comes in. As Faulkner wrote, the past isn't dead. It's not even past. And I think that's one of the themes that emerges in this book.
Yeah, it does, let me tell you. So, tell us about Earl. And he has to investigate three murders of the past of
yes.
inmates. And why does J. Edgar Hoover, he's an interesting character, the way you portrayed him, it's so real. Why does J. Edgar Hoover want him out of his way? And why does he have, what does he have against Earl, and why? He doesn't like Earl.
You know, that's a great question. And the answer is more of an aesthetic answer than it is a simple answer. And that is, every scene needs to be defined by conflict. If you have a scene in a thriller where two people agree on everything, well, what's the scene doing in the book?
Yeah.
Thrillers are driven by conflict, and the idea of pitting, in Strong Cold Dead, this is something I do. In Strong Cold Dead, I pit Caitlin's great great grandfather Steel Dust Jack Strong against John D. Rockefeller, pitting Earl Strong against J. Edgar Hoover. It's because their agendas are not, to answer your question, in addition to always looking for ways to stage conflict, it's because their agendas are not the same. Earl Strong is after a killer of those three cellmates. Their fourth cellmate killed them and escaped from this prison camp. Earl is after the killer because of what he did. J. Edgar mm-hmm. Hoover is after the killer because of who he is and what he could do if he gets out and what he could do if he doesn't get caught. But you don't know, and this is – you don't know all the answers. You don't find out the revelations until very late in the book. The fun of Strong to the Bone or any thriller is you're essentially putting a puzzle together. People love mysteries because they want to find out who did it. People love thrillers because they want to find out how they did it, and more to the point, how they're going to do it. It's two different approaches, but
mm-hmm.
the end result is the same. You're trying to assemble a picture. You have the pieces. And in fact, you have more pieces than Caitlin has, because you see scenes from, and you read the book from the villain's point of view. Caitlin doesn't have that advantage. So you mm-hmm. see all the perspectives, and this is what I love about writing in third person as opposed to writing in first person. You can, you know, you can do both. You can get into the heads of the characters, but you can present the entire picture to the reader. So the reader has more information than the characters who live within the world of the novel. The reader knows more and can play along better. It's almost like the Caitlin Strong books are interactive. It's almost like you're right in the action with Caitlin, and it's like choose your own adventure if you were a kid. And in mm-hmm. fact, I think the reason thrillers are the most popular genre is because they make us feel like kids again. They make us feel the same way we did when we read a book, a choose your own adventure book, where you could make up where it went. Well, the difference as we get to adults is we watch someone like Caitlin Strong doing what you did as a kid in a choose your adventure book.
Well, you brought another issue out, by the way.
There's
another one in here, people. Yes, you did.
Oh, boy.
I was watching this news this morning, and we have Dylan Masters, who's so much like his father.
Oh, isn't he?
And he's working for a Spanish man who employs illegals. He's hot-headed, and he decides to go after the boys and protect the illegals. And if you were watching the news this morning, they were having a group of people that in Peekskill that were protesting. They're called Dreamers, and they're trying to make it part of the bill that they're protected so that they don't have to be deported. So this was sort of brought up that issue about it, about protecting the illegals. And we also have Ryan Fiske, who I didn't like, and this was Armand, who I really didn't like. So tell us about them. And actually, I'm trying to figure out why, and this is another issue, why didn't the school bring up the fact that he's an abusive father?
Well, you know, the Armand Fiske is the neo-Nazi villain of the book, not the sexual assaulter. That's somebody else. Ryan Fiske is his ne'er-do-well son, who's the same age as Dylan, who is Court Wesley Masters' son, but also Caitlin's surrogate son. And the thing about these two characters is they are both prisoners of their impulse. I think the nature mm-hmm. of villainy is the ability. What separates the villain from the hero, and here's something I've never said before, I'd be curious to hear what you think down the road and also what your listeners think. One of the differences between a villain and a hero is the ability to control impulses. And I think that the thing these two Fiskers, Armand and Ryan, older and younger, have in common is they cannot control their impulses. One of the most powerful scenes in this book is, you know, Ryan is not his father. He's a weak kid. You know, he hangs out with his mm-hmm. kid, his friends, and drinks beer and smokes pot. They've basically appropriated a ghost town in Texas for their own existence. They're running a criminal enterprise out of a town they've basically taken over and built up from scratch. I base this on these towns in California where this really still happens. It was also the basis for the show Sons of Anarchy that ran on FX for a long time. We were a biker gang basically running a town. So one of the most powerful scenes in this book is when Ryan Fiske runs afoul of his villainous Nazi father, and his father pours gasoline on him. And when he does that, the real powerful thing about that scene is it's not, hey, this is what you get for pissing me off. He really intends to set his own son on fire in that moment. He actually intends to do it. Now, he doesn't do it. But when he throws that gasoline impulsively, he's intending. So the basic thing is they've got this world they've built where they don't have to justify their actions to anyone. Mm-hmm. As long as they stay out of the world at large, as long as Ryan doesn't do what he does, which runs him afoul of young Dylan, which then gets Court Wesley Masters to visit the town. It's like they've blown up a balloon, and because of Ryan Fisker's actions, Court Wesley comes and sticks a pin in it and blows it up. And Court Wesley's a pretty impulsive guy, too. And mm-hmm. I think one of the themes in this book that works so well is the theme of father and son. It's a very powerful theme. in American literature in general, dating all the way back to Huckleberry Finn, Huck and Jim, and in the last of the Mohican series, Natty Bumpo and Chingachgook. The father-son relationship, and it's often metaphorical and symbolic, more than it is based on blood, as it is in Strong to the Bone, is a very powerful theme, and it really pops in this book. The difference between how Court Wesley is raising his son, he's raising his son. His son's 22, but we don't grow. I mean, I'm 60. I'm still being raised. You know, how Court Wesley is raising Dylan and how Armin Fisker is raising Ryan. And, of course, that leads to one of – it's only 4 pages long, but it feels like 40 when I wrote it and when I read it. And that's the action scene set at the house where Court Wesley, Caitlin, and Dylan live. There is something – I write very visual action scenes. It's probably my greatest strength. Mm-hmm. But when your home is invaded, it becomes visceral as well as visual. There's, you know, the Sam Peckinpah movie, Straw Dogs, not the remake, the Dustin Hoffman version, is brilliant in its climax because that is what he's what Peckinpah is doing. He's deconstructing the home as it's perceived. The great scene in the end of The Birds, the classic Alfred Hitchcock movie, where the family has basically nailed themselves inside a house to keep the birds out. And of course, the birds are going to get in anyway. And Rod Taylor and Tippi Hedren and Jessica Tandy, and they're, you know, just watching that scene as they keep trying to keep the windows bolted and the windows covered with wood. That's the equivalent of the scene that comes to change all the stakes about halfway through Strong to the Bone. Something happens in the book which changes everything for all the characters. And it's not something that anyone planned to do, and this is what I love about this book. It's so organic. People aren't necessarily planning to do all the stuff they do when the book starts, but they end up doing it because of the circumstances that unfold, that you watch, how Caitlin deals with this younger rape victim. On the one hand, she wants to help her. On the other hand, she wants information. This mm-hmm. victim is the only person who can describe, the only other person who can identify the man, this man who raped both of them. So there's so much going on in Strong to the Bone. It's like, I got to tell you, it's a few thousand words longer than the last couple books in the series, 16 pages of typeface, 368 instead of 352. But if that's, those 16 extra pages feel like 160 emotionally, because there's so much in this book, there's so much in it, you know, that's unpacked in this book. It's almost like I wrote 3 books in one.
That's true, because you had all those issues. So let's get to the nitty gritty here, because we're getting close.
I thought that's what we were doing.
We're getting more. Ha ha.
Oh, we're digging deeper.
That's it, exactly right. Now, Armand Fisker has an ulterior motive, and he's a horrible person. And he wanted to create a bioweapon, and he thinks he's right, and he never backs down. So that's the first thing. And what happens when Ryan and his friends decide to go after Dylan? But let's talk about what he's trying to do. Armand Fisker had an ulterior motive. He wants to create a deadly bioweapon. Why? Does he want to do this?
Well, that is essentially, first, I don't want to say what motivates him in the end to finally unleash this weapon, because it's a major twist, but it ties in with that gunfight that takes place when Ryan Fisker and his idiot friends show up in San Antonio and in the suburbs of Shavano Park and try to kill Dylan, Caitlin Strong, and Court Wesley. I think it comes down to the fact that when I started this book, I looked around the world and saw, and it's very scary, to see the Nazi Party winning seats, the most seats they've won since World War II, in the German Parliament. In other countries, like France, like Austria, like Hungary, like Poland, the ultra-right nationalist party, the equivalent of what we have in the White House right now, President Steve Bannon, right? The equivalent of what we have in the – this is not an American trend. It is a national trend, an international trend. Brexit would be another example of what I'm talking about. So what this weapon, and this gets to the answer to your question about Armin Fisker and this bioweapon, he sees this weapon as the ability of this drug network, this, because basically he's built an international drug distribution network of ultra-right wingers like him who are neo-Nazis, but they're doing it for business. They're making money. They're wiping out their rival gangs, undercutting prices. They're businessmen. But then Armin Fisker gets into his hands something that could allow them to take the next step, something that could allow them to seize power in these countries. Imagine, I got to tell you something. I love the state of Israel. I hate the state of Israel. But I just said how I just contradicted myself because I love the country. I hate the government because Netanyahu's government is so right wing, is so fascist. This and what Trump is doing today. This is such a perfect time to be having this conversation about strong to the bone, because what Trump is doing today by recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, something that no country has done in the 70 years. Of Israel's, that America has never done in the 70 years of Israel's existence. I don't think any country has ever done it. Is that you are giving a license to the haters. You are bad people. And I call Netanyahu a bad person, just like I call Trump a bad person. They cling to power. They don't care about their countries and they don't care about their people. They care about themselves. They care about their own perpetuation. Of power.
Yeah, you're right.
And by doing the things they do, they give license to the people who are evil. They empower the people who are evil. You unleash terrorism when you give terrorism a reason to be. If there was peace in the Middle East, if Netanyahu and his whack job right-wing government really wanted peace, that's the way you eliminate violence. That's the way you eliminate hate. What's happening in Israel foreshadowed what's happening in this unleashing of hate in America. Unleashing of hate where, and what do you need to know about what's wrong with where we are right now? You need to go no further than a Trump rally to see the things those people cheer. To see the composition of those crowds, almost all white men. That's not America any more than the 30% of the people that Netanyahu – that's the old – Netanyahu has the support of 30% of Israel. And look at what he's doing. Trump has the support of probably around 30% now. I think the latest poll has him down in the low 30s. Even one has him in the high 20s.
That high.
You know, well, that's because you have that element that is never – going to desert him because he has brought them out of the shadows and into the light. And you know something? Here's what great villains do for us. And yes, Trump is a classical Shakespearean villain. That's the only way I can put it. He's not as smart as Lear and Othello and the others, even Macbeth. He's a moron. But he has he is a classical villain in that sense. The great thing villains do is they wake up. They give license to evil, like Steve Bannon, like the alt-right, Breitbart, that whole thing. And by doing that, here's the good thing. They activate the rest of us. They make the rest of us realize it's gone too far. And it's almost like a defense mechanism, nature taking care of itself. It's interesting. Because
I don't think he comprehends half of what he's doing at all. And the part is this morning I was watching Channel 4, and the head of the editor in chief of Time magazine was there, and he was going to pick the president of China, came in number 3 as person of the year, The frightening part was that they picked Trump as person of the year number two and the silence seekers as person of the year. And that's all I'll say about that. Armand is guilty of hurting his employees. He's using a wonder drug and he likes to hurt other people. So when Ryan and his friends decide to go over and, you know, take care of Dylan, Dylan decides to take action. So what happens when Dylan actually tries to save his father's life? How are they going to protect him now from what he did?
Well, I think the fun, first off, the answer to that is one of the great things about being a writer is exploring how characters mm-hmm. react to crises and how they react to mm-hmm. something they've done. And in this book, you're going to see Dylan kill somebody for the first time, and he does it to save his father's life. So there's a nobility about it. I honestly believe that when you do something that you would never do otherwise in the service of another, I think the powerful thing about that sequence is Dylan doesn't feel guilty about what he did. He doesn't regret what he did. He would do it all over again. Now, he's grown up. He's been through a lot, this kid. So he's not a normal 21-year-old in Strong to the Bone. He's been through so much. I think what we learn in Strong to the Bone about Dylan and people in general is tragedy is the result of someone not acting often. Tragedies happen sometimes because people fail to do the hard thing. Dylan does the hard thing. And I think, and again, I love coming on your show. We get a full hour, and I get to say things I never say and I never will say again probably. But I think what defines a hero as much as anything is a hero does the hard thing, not just the easy thing. It isn't easy to kill somebody else. It isn't easy to pull that trigger knowing the thing, knowing what it's going to be, but you're doing it for someone else. Definition of heroism is not an act in service to self. Heroism is an act in service to others. And I think Dylan doesn't necessarily define himself as a hero. We've never looked at him that way before, but his nature, the fact that he has to always be protecting somebody, you know, he can't, you know, when he was a little boy, he would, you know, adopt stray animals and nurse them back to health. Well, now he does that with people, you know, like you made a great point before about how these illegal mm-hmm. aliens are being harassed by this neo-Nazi gang and Dylan stands up for them. And of course that leads to big problems and he probably would have been killed earlier in the book if not for the efforts of your favorite character, Guillermo Pass. we always talk a little bit about,
I love,
you know,
him,
Caitlin.
Yeah.
He's you know, it's interesting when you create a character as who's defined by violence when you first meet them and continues to a great degree to be defined by violence, who is mm-hmm. essentially the moral center of the series now. I have so much fun with his character, and basically he's a former colonel in the Venezuelan secret police, the deadliest man, the deadliest assassin, the deadliest killer in the world, who originally comes to Texas to kill Caitlin, but then becomes her protector, her knight in shining armor, her guardian angel. And he's 7 feet tall, weighs 300 pounds, solid muscle. He's killed more people than malaria in the course of mm-hmm. these books. And yet he's the moral center because I have so much fun casting him in different things. You know, every book he's doing something different. And Strong, you know, he's in Strong to the Bone, he's volunteering at his soup kitchen. In Strong as Steel, the book I'm working on now, he's volunteering at a daycare center. And, you know, so part of the fun of these books is when you do a series, the way you keep it fresh is you put your characters in different scenarios. You put them in different backdrops. So if you're reading the book, whether it's you're reading Caitlin for the ninth time, or whether you're reading it for the ninth time, it always feels like the first, because mm-hmm. you're going to see things about her and about the other characters you've never seen before. In Strong to the Bone, you find out she was sexually assaulted 18 years before. How does she deal with that? Well, in Strong as Steel, spoiler alert, little preview for our interview next year, she found out. We find out something else about Caitlin we didn't know before. Something else major. Something else potentially shattering. The difference in Strong as Steel, the next book, number 10, not coming out till 2018, is this time Caitlin doesn't know it. Caitlin is as surprised as we are when she finds out. And it is going to be I can't wait to get to that part of the book. I'm the same way. I'm like a reader when I'm writing. I can't wait to get to certain parts. I can't wait. It's what keeps me going. It's why I write 25 pages a day some days, because I want to get to something. I want to get to a certain scene, because I always write in order. I never say, oh, I really want to write this scene, so I'm going to write it now. I had a chance to play Fran Lewis one day, and I interviewed George R.R. Martin at Brown University. Mm. And something he said I'll never forget as a writer. And again, writers in your audience, pay attention to what I'm about to say. When George R.R. Martin wrote the book that had the red wedding scene in it, we all know what the red wedding scene is, if you're familiar with Game of Thrones. He wrote that scene last. He wrote it out of sequence after the rest of the book was done, because he knew if he wrote it in sequence, he'd have to end the book there. Because it was going to be so hard for him to write that scene, he would not be able to write anything else. And I never, that the creative mind, you create characters and live with them for so long. Getting rid of them, I don't do that. George R.R. Martin does it all the time in Game of Thrones and Walking Dead. It's a different kind of storytelling. But it's the idea, so I write in sequence. Basically, I write the same way you read the book. So I know in 50 pages I'm going to get to a certain scene. I can't wait to get there. And I know.
Well, Cheryl emailed me. She said to tell you that she agrees with everything you said, and she wants a galley before, like I do, for the next one, too.
Well, I can't give it to you yet. I'll tell you what. Remind me in the spring. I can get you in an even earlier stage than the galley. But you know something? At its heart, writing is fun the same way reading is. And if I enjoy writing a book as much as I enjoy writing the Caitlin Strong books, like Strong to the Bone, I know the reader is going to have as much fun as I did. I'm amazed at writers who hate to write. Because if you hate to write, how am I going to enjoy reading what you wrote? I don't understand. You know, writing is not pulling teeth. You know, writing it shouldn't be something you need to be an alcoholic to do, but unfortunately, it's often been that for writers. Normally, not thriller writers, but writers who have higher aspirations. I don't know what that means exactly. You're not going to see Caitlin Strong get nominated for a National Book Award, but then again, I think the points and how thriller writers, not just me. But you look at what Lee Child does, look at what John Hart does, look at what James Lee Burke does, David Morrell, thriller writers, Sandra Brown, I could go on forever, Tess Garrison, who you've had on the show, thriller writers are storytellers, but we're also doing some things, I think, with our characters in our books that people, the subtext, that people don't get because the stories are so much fun. So people might say, well, that book doesn't have any literary merit. It's just fun. It's just pulp fiction. Yeah, that may be true. But, you know, I think that there's as much subtext in a lot of thrillers I read as there is subtext in straight novels. I used to be smart. I was an English and American lit major at Brown back before I lost my mind. And my IQ shrunk, the thing that always fascinated me, I thought the writers I enjoyed reading the most, like Hemingway and Faulkner, I thought they were at their best when they were writing action scenes. I thought they were, you know, Hemingway was never better than when he wrote a war scene. I thought Faulkner was never better than when he wrote The Bear, the coming of age story of a father and son going into the woods to hunt a giant killer bear. Everything Faulkner was doing in Absalom, Absalom, Sound and the Fury, As I Lay Dying, all the things he did in those classics, he also does in The Bear. The difference is the delivery mechanism. In The Bear, it's a coming-of-age story of violence and rage and this beautiful, this wonderful, conflicted, but also incredibly tense and suspenseful quest to find this bear. It's hard for me to tell you how he does it in the other books. I don't remember them as clearly as I remember The Bear. So what does that say? It probably says a lot about me, which for better or for worse. But I think it also says that if you give people a great story, what you're showing them is going to resonate stronger. But if you don't know, if you don't tell them a story that has a coherent beginning, middle, and end with all the elements of what a thriller is, sometimes they miss the point you were trying to make. Lee Child, I love listening to him talk about Reacher and Reacher's violence and Reacher's capacity for violence. And Lee is touching on so many hot button issues today with his Jack Reacher character. And, you know, and he's doing the same. I mean, the most recent one, the Midnight Line, you're going to see a lot of the same things that I deal with in my books with Caitlin Strong. You're going
to
see
maybe
in Lee's
someday
books.
He'll send me one to review. I can't get them. I don't know why. And I've asked his publicist, and they got the same answer I got from someone else 2 weeks ago. Why don't you buy the book? I said, but I'm a reviewer, and I've met Lee Child, whatever, and I can't get them. But before I forget, on Monday, there's going to be another blockbuster, people. D.P. Lyle's going to be here for A-List.
Oh, you're in for a treat. You're in for a treat.
Oh, yes.
One of the best.
And on the 12th, FBI agent Michael Tabman and I are going to go and talk about the issues that we're talking about in the news, besides the fact we're going to talk about, as an educator, talk about safety in schools, what's happening with metal detectors not being in schools, and for those of you that don't know, the murder that happened last month in Pier 67 was the school I went to school in the South Bronx. So we're going to talk about that. On the 14th, another one of my favorite people, Beneath the Depths, Bruce Coffin will be here. On the 19th, Reese Hirsch will be here for surveillance. And on the 21st, to round out December, you would think Gerard de Moraney wrote a new series, Joshua's Journey. And on January 4th, we're going to do something different. Pastor Michael Jones, you can believe I've learned how to be a Seventh-day Adventist. I learned a lot from reading the book. And we're going to talk about his book and his mission and how he helps the homeless in Florida. So we have about 7 more minutes. So I have a question. Murder, drugs, money, child abuse, guilt, self-recrimination, links to Hitler, money laundering, and revenge are just some of the issues that are brought to light in this book. Those are the ones I found. So for those of you that don't know, Fran always gets the point somehow. So how does that connect? And when Caitlin deals with Jones, he wants to kick her off the team. How come?
Well, Jones is a CIA guy, a Homeland guy. He's a mysterious guy. He's a classic staple of thriller fiction, both in movies, television shows, and books, where he's the guy who's kind of on the inside, but he's also on the outside. You know, he's kind of a rebel. And he and Caitlin, again, you read off that litany of things that are going on in this book, and I get accused a lot. I get criticized a lot for just jamming so much stuff into my books. But I think that's what life is like. I think life can be overwhelming too. But in the case of Jones, to answer your question, they have this great relationship in that they both use each other. You know, they have their dialogue, and that's the fun of these books, is the way people talk, the way they go at each other verbally. And Caitlin and Jones are both old school. They like doing things the old-fashioned way, and not you know kicking ass and taking names and not writing a report about it in the morning, but in this book, even Jones, and this is what's Jones is worried, even he's worried that Caitlin is going to go too far. And her actions actually jeopardize a family that he is guarding in the witness protection program. One of his, you know, he has a secret job at Homeland, and someone has helped Homeland get some really bad guys. And Caitlin's relentlessness and refusal to back off puts those people in jeopardy. Unintended consequences. And I think it's important that even Superman made mistakes. Even Batman isn't perfect. Caitlin Strong, I think part of the nature of her character is sometimes her obsessive nature runs her afoul and brings her up to a line where she could inadvertently do damage. And Jones, who is no saint in his own right, is the one who kind of reels her back in. He has to reel her back in. But Caitlin's a hurricane. You know, it's Hurricane Caitlin. You know, watching her trying to control her own nature has become one of the great things and the fun I have with this book. It's almost like, and the best way I can describe her, Fran, is it's like she stepped out of the 19th century. She got off a train into 2017, and she's a gunfighter. She's Wyatt Earp. She's Doc Holliday. She's Wild Bill Hickok. She's that mentality. That mentality, which is what the Texas Rangers have been and continue to be to an extent. She kind of personifies it in an exaggerated sense. She is that person, and that's the nature of her heroism. Because the fun in discussing these books are you have so many good people, so many heroes in this series, but each is a hero for different reasons. The same way that the two villains in Strong to the Bone are villains for entirely different reasons. And when they get together, they're these evil, you know, the worst thing you can ever have in life is when two evil ends or when two evil goals join forces because they realize they can accomplish their goals faster. Perfect example, Steve Bannon and the alt-right and Donald Trump. The alt-right wants power. Donald Trump wants to be president. You have two evil groups, two evil entities that individually can't accomplish their goals, but together can. That is, you know, I didn't mean that as a metaphor for what happens in Strong to the Bone, but I think there are people who will read the book and see it as a metaphor for two people, two bad guys, who can't accomplish their evil ends through means of their own, but can only do it through the collective means of themselves together.
Well, I have one more question because we got about two more minutes. This is a good one. Are you ready, people, for this one?
All your questions are good.
I try, yeah. I had like 17 more, but I don't think we'll get to them. Caitlin finally gets closure, but not how everyone thinks. Will she ever, and this is a hard one because I know and I understand, will she ever reconcile what happened to her? And the other question is she ever going to marry Kurt Wesley?
The answer to the second question, I think, is no.
Okay, good. That's good.
I don't see it because it's not their nature. Gunfighters are loners, and heroes are loners. That's what the Greeks taught us about heroism, that you can be a hero, but you cannot live among men. You can't. It's a zero-sum game. You can't have both. And I think so. They're not going to get married. They can't. And what was the first part of the question? Because I answered the second one first.
Okay. Can Caitlin ever get closure about what happened to her? Will she ever reconcile what happened to her?
I think she reconciles what happened to her. She realizes that even if she's able to slay the dragon, the damage the dragon did will never go away. In other words, killing the dragon doesn't erase the scar the dragon's bite left. And what Caitlin realizes above all else in the end of this book is her nature is her nature. She is who she is. Scar tissue doesn't heal. You can cover it up, but it doesn't heal. So I think that is what she learns as far as where this is going to go. And I hadn't thought of it that way before, so I'm glad you asked me that question. And I hope somebody, I hope I can remember what I said, because I'd like to, that's what I'd like to file away.
You get to listen to it afterwards. This is going to go live. So, final two questions. What about giving Luke and Dylan more of a spotlight? And are you going to give do more of a story with Luke because he came out in the last book?
That's two great questions, and the answer is there are some characters who are you have to find everyone's role. Every character has a role, and the worst thing a writer can do is try to give a character a role that doesn't fit them, doesn't fit their scope, doesn't fit the size, doesn't fit their development. It since my books develop organically, you know, I think that Dylan is we know more about Dylan than we know about Luke. Luke's younger. He did come out as out of the closet. Came out as gay in Strong Light of Day. That was the emotional core of that particular book. And he had he's 18 now. He's 17. So I think there's going to be an opportunity. The problem is how many scenes can you do from a character's perspective if the reader is. You know, that you can only have so many POVs. So I think what you're asking me is, do I want to devote more point of view? But every time, if I give more POV to Luke or Dylan, I'm taking it away from other characters. So it
That's
has
true.
To be a it has to be a balance. I think I get a kick out of writers who do so well at spinning characters off, like Robert Crace, who spun Joe Pike off. I didn't think Second Bananas could ever be leads, but it's been proven that they can. It doesn't always work, but I think some people are meant to be seen in small doses and others are meant to be seen in large doses. And I think the kids in this series have a role, but this is a series with that stars some pretty powerful adults, and their interaction with the kids will always be important to how the books unfold and develop. But I think it's dangerous to write the Hardy Boys. And if I did a book with Dylan and Luke spotlight, top lining in the spotlight, it would essentially become the Hardy Boys.
No, I agree with you. So, last question. Where can we find out about all of these? And when are you going to write another one of the other ones with Fabrizio? Because those were good, let me tell you.
We're going to pass on the Fabrizio question is tough because that's work for hire. We work great together, but I'm a lone wolf. I'm like Caitlin. I'm a loner. I much prefer working alone. I do not like working with other people. I like to take my ball and keep my ball and play with my ball and not share my ball. And where you can learn, you know what I tell people? When a book first comes out, there's so much in the news, there's so much written, there's so many reviews. I would Google Strong to the Bone by John Land or add some other stuff to it. That way you get the most recent stuff. You can go to my website, but I haven't been updating it. I would go to Goodreads. I'd go to my Amazon page, look at what other people are saying about the book. Because if you go to what I did, what I created, all you're going to get is what I want you to see. Go online and read objective opinions. Amazon, read about the Strong to the Bone and how people and I have never said that before. I've never given that advice before. I'm doing it today because I think that this is a different kind of book, and I think it's going to be received and recognized and acknowledged and analyzed in a different way because of the current issues that we've talked about. I mean, we should take this. Mm-hmm. We should frame this hour interview, because I think of all, how many interviews have you and I done. I think this is probably the best one we've ever done. Many ways, because you know we've hit on things that define why people love reading books, and why they love reading thrillers. Not just mine. There's so many thrillers out there, but what is it about thrillers that makes them so popular and so impossible to resist? And I think what we've talked about today has gotten to the heart of that.
So I want to thank you a million times for doing this, seriously. And I can't wait to see you guys at the Phila Fest because, you know, after all, that's my one vacation for the year, people. What
Me
can
too.
I say? Yeah, and hopefully we'll all get to be there, and I'll get to meet some new people,
Not
and
good.
That'll be nice. And I want to thank you a million times. I can't wait to get your next one. And those of you that you know want to listen, the show is live now. I put the link live on Blog Talk Radio, and I will be back Monday with A-List. And right now, I'm going to put your review on Amazon with 27 stars. I'm going to post it on my review on my review site. John's got the best historical fishkin book for 2017, and I'm excited because I gave 9 other people awards, and yours is the only one in historical fiction. And I was excited because I gave Alan Topol, you know, Thriller Award. And even though Dennis Palumbo's book is coming out in February, Head Wounds won, even though I read it. But I read it this year. So what? And that's another psychological thriller. That's fantastic. So everybody, check my list of great authors, and the awards are on my Facebook wall. John, thank you a million times.
Oh,
everybody,
thank
have
you,
a nice day, and bye.